Hi, my name is Sam Blezard. Welcome to Comms from the Shed, the interview show where you get to hear from a range of diverse and interesting voices. In this series, we'll be taking an informal look at life, talking to people who've been doing incredible things, and asking them about their hopes for the future in both their personal and professional lives. Hope you enjoy it. Today we are joined by Sarah Lazenby. Sarah is a communications specialist who started her career in regional media as a journalist and editor before going on to work for the Sun newspaper. Since then, she's devoted the majority of her career to finding the kernel of truth in the employee engagement experience, whether that was as head of internal comms for Wardour, AXA, HMRC, the Cabinet Office, or Royal Mail. She's worked in multiple sectors, including retail, financial services, IT, manufacturing, oil and gas, utilities, rail, telecoms, and UK government. Sarah is a fellow of the UK's Institute of Internal Communication, an award-winning writer and editor, and has recently gone back to her journalism roots at healthcare brand Roche Diagnostics. Sarah, welcome to Comms from the Shed.
Well, thank you very much, Sam. My goodness, I thought you were going to lose all oxygen as you were reading out all the sectors I've worked across. I mean, to be honest with you, I've been working quite a long time, which is why there's been so many sectors, all of whom have been, to be fair, very fascinating. But my heart at the moment is, and I'm not just saying this because they pay my salary, my heart at the moment is in healthcare. I think that's something that I've worked in for the last decade, and I really feel it aligns with my purpose without sounding too pretentious about that.
I did have a massively effective oxygen mask when I was going through that intro, which was helpful. And as you gave a reasonably lengthy answer, I was able to just regain my breath there. Listen, the whole purpose of this, the reason I wanted to have you on the show, apart from the fact that we worked together in the past and enjoyed working together in the past, is that I think at some level, we both sort of value the journalistic impulse. And I think we've both brought it into our own sort of specialism. I mean, do you see yourself as an investigative journalist at heart, really?
You know, investigative journalists, and I do know a lot of journalists still. It does sound incredibly professional and, you know, just really like there's investigative journalists and investigative journalists. I would say to you that I'm incredibly nosy. I've always been nosy. I was nosy as a child, and the only thing I was ever really good at as a child was writing. And so I went into journalism because I loved writing, and I still love writing. I've been writing for many, many years. It's like breathing to me. So if you say investigative journalist, I use some of those disciplines still, and I always have in my corporate life. So, you know, the who, what, why, where, when, and how, you know, they were ingrained in me at a very early age. I was 18 when I started as what they called a trainee reporter on a newspaper. And, you know, and honestly, they've stood me in good stead, those very simple questions. I tend to also say I've got an extra one, which is there anything else you think I should know? Which over the years has thrown up some absolutely gold moments, you know, just very casually, you know, people dropping things into the conversation when you think your interview is over. So if I give you a prime example, was many years ago when I was working on an old employee publication for an oil and gas company, and I'm part of my role was to find the stories from the forecourts and down the country and eat abroad, and you know you'd have what you call, and even in those days you'd have your sort of community journalists or people that you could rely on who sort of were across the employee base who would kind of have their little fingers into various pies about what was going on. Anyway, cut a long story short, I once asked some retail folk down on one of these forecourts at the end of an interview about something entirely different. Was there anything else they thought I should know? And they said, what else? Nightmare last week. We were held up by masked robbers. Now, you know, I mean, I just think It's extreme and it's a total true story. I do think that that final question, is there anything else you think I should know or that you feel you haven't told me and I should know, is critical for anyone in the world of corporate bonds.
Oh, absolutely. And just before I forget, what was the regional title you first worked for before you went to work for The Sun?
Oh, I worked for a number of newspapers in my hometown of Eastbourne and then across Sussex. So it was the Eastbourne Herald and Gazette series and this wonderful thing called Eastbourne Advertiser, which I had to do with my left kneecap once a week. It was just basically for the press releases and taught me that you should never, ever use an image with a press release and not give it credit, because the image I used at the time was someone in a pair of Levi jeans, but didn't wear it Levi. And then I got a letter from Levi's in the US who'd actually somehow or other found my print newspaper, which, you know, about three people, including my mother, read, and just threatened me with legal actions.
Amazing. There's a story, yeah. And I mean, that's pre-social media age. I mean,
pre-social media. Mm.
So listen, tell me, what was The Sun like back in the day when you worked there? Because I mean, the stories about working for tabloids are many, but what's your kind of recollection of that time and the kind of age you were and the sort of things that you saw?
Well, I was still, you know, she said nervously, I was still very, very young, but what I was determined to do, and we're talking about a time where on the local newspaper where I worked, we still hadn't actually moved to two computers, everybody. I was working still on typewriters, I was desperate to learn this, what they called new technology. And there was no way I could do that down on the South Coast. So I actually wrote to The Sun as my CV, really, in effect, was a Sun story about me. And I wrote it in the style of a Sun story about saving Sarah on the South Coast. And I think that I just think they hadn't had something like that for a while. And they scooped me up on the basis of that and plonked me onto the news features desk, where I was asked to basically, you know, and I'll be honest with you, it was a brutal time in the 80s, and make stories up and then kind of ring people up and accuse them of things. And it just really was completely against the grain for me. Because I love writing and I love meeting people, so to actually accuse them of things was a little bit too much for me. That's a long story short. It was in the reign of the very infamous Kelvin McKenzie, and it was just wonderful. I mean, it was just a smorgasbord of fantastic characters there. You know, people who were you know, I mean, I knew a guy whose whole job was to draw the outline of the Page Three girl in pencil on a piece of paper before it was set, and he got 25 grand a year for doing it. I mean, it was just absolutely phenomenal that someone could actually have that as a job. And he'd been a sports editor in some local paper, but he said, who wouldn't move for £25,000 to draw the outline of these beautiful women? There was a famous women's editor at the time who used to have to queue, as did a lot of the editors, outside Kelvin McKenzie's office with their pages in their hand, and he wanted to see them, and you'd watch people go in and then people come out looking a little bit emotional. You know, he'd often come out saying, well, there's not enough this and that in it. I won't say the rude words on a podcast, but basically involved, you know, activity, there's not enough of that activity in it. So it was a very interesting education. And the other bit that I really enjoyed is I spent some time on the subs desk where we were working on new technology, but the job they gave me there was to edit some of the Dear Deirdre letters for the Agony Aunt column. And you know, I'm just saying to somebody, but are these actually real? Because what I was actually getting on the screen was, you know, this is about 400 words. It's three or four different from one person in Bournemouth. And you need to make it 3 centimetres long. And the headline's only got to be this number of characters and across this thing. And you couldn't electronically actually make a headline to send it to print without it exactly fitting what they told you, because if you press the wrong button, it sent off an alarm. So I found myself having to edit these really crazy letters to length and to deadline, while the terror of the site, you know, the bell ringing if I didn't get it right. So I have to tell you, it really sped up my attention to deadline, like big time.
I'm just chuckling to myself, you know, if any corporate communicators are listening, if they had a bell that went off, if they didn't completely format everything to the right word length and shape, that would be quite an amusing thing to
Yeah.
consider.
It's a good discipline. I mean, not the bell ringing and not the swearing and stuff like that, but it was a good discipline to feel that I was out of my comfort zone. You know, I was very young, still in career. I was out of my comfort zone. I'd managed to get this role, and I just really enjoyed it. I mean, having to write in the style of a son, the son style, it was incredibly complicated at the time. I mean, people can poo-poo this sort of writing. But it really honed my editing, and it really helped think about the target audience. It really was a great learning experience.
No, there's a real discipline to journalistic writing, especially tabloid writing, that I agree that people don't understand. I mean, I've been in some conversations recently where I've been chatting about similar things to this, a real love of kind of writing fundamentally. But I think you get to a point in your life where you realize that being a great editor is maybe as important, maybe more important than being actually a great writer, isn't it? Which is kind of what you're
Yeah.
talking about.
You can, as a writer, to be able to write about anything is a really good exercise. So my first editor, taught us to write about anything. Like, part of our training was go to seven yard sales, seven jumble sales, and I want seven stories, with nothing to go on. Create seven content from nothing is a really, really good discipline. And I think as an editor, sometimes it's about looking at the copy you've been given and then just really punching it up, sort of aren't going to lose. People got we know very little attention now. People have never really had a massive amount of attention. I think it's a myth to say we've got the attention span less than a goldfish. I think we've always probably had that, in different ways. And so to actually hone down what's already been written, it's probably very, very good to make it really punchy and really targeted is a massively good use.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I must ask you, before we move on, if you had to pick one story that's really made you laugh when you reflect back on it, what was one of the funniest stories from your time at The Sun? Is there any that still kind of tickle your funny bone now?
I think not on the Sun. I think really all of those Dear Deirdre stories were unbelievable. But yes, there were 4 million readers at the time, and there were thousands and thousands of letters, every permutation of someone's tragedy played out in them. You just had to focus on one of them. So I do think that for me, there were many, many human interest stories if you think about it in those. But I've had some, I've had a lot of what I would call corporate journalism jobs in my career after that, where in those days, internal comms was largely focused with pre-internet days and pre some of the work that people have done on behavioural change and things like that. And so, I've had some brilliant, lovely little tales of, if I think about some of them, there was a salesman that I met in a particular organisation who had a penchant for being a Jedi. On and wasn't being quite corporate at work. Now, the fact that he was quite corporate at work and a bit of a Jedi on the side, he did tell me it was a religion, and it wasn't, and I had to be, I had to be very respectful of it. But it was challenging at times to be respectful of it because it was just such a shock because he wasn't the kind of guy that just imagined him having any kind of hobby like that. But there you go. There was also a marketing executive who I found later bred llamas. He lived on the Isle of Dogs and bred llamas. Now, it's a hobby. He just loved llamas, and his sister bought him one, and he decided to get it a pair, and then another a mate, and then he did what he needed to do, and it was a bit of an expert on it, And I think we've, there was also a. Another job that I did for when I worked agency side, I used to work with a fantastic Trident Communications. We used to work on these daily newspapers for Flight International around the world, and I remember flying to Singapore to do a daily newspaper for Flight International. Now, I know one end of a rocket from another, if I'm frank, but they sent me out to get the kind of colour pieces from all the exhibitors. And in conversation with one chap, he turned out to be, he'd been a pilot for the US billionaire eccentric Howard Hughes, as you do. I think it was one of those questions where I didn't have to wait till, is there anything else you think I should know? We did get there, and he gave me a flying jacket, not from Howard Hughes, but he gave me a flying jacket. And it's just the most fascinating story about his life with this guy. So I am fascinated with people, and I know it sounds a bit trite, but that people are fascinating, largely. And if you can actually get them to share what it is that makes them tick, then I think you've got some brilliant, brilliant storytelling.
No, I completely agree. I mean, I know you see writing and content creation as a strength. Do you think there's some mischief in it at some level? You know, perhaps the need, to quote one of my favorite musicians, George Clinton, he once said to be a positive nuisance. I mean, have you seen yourself as the architect of positive nuisance at points in your career?
Positive nuisance, I think, despite, you know, what people may think of me working on the sun, and to be fair, I stopped working on the sun when I found that it really just was a little bit against my personal values, and I had the opportunity to move into the world from there, which I didn't even know existed, like a parallel universe. A positive nuisance, I think I ask a lot of questions, and sometimes, you know, it's not to be difficult, it's to get to the nub of what's needed, a way of making more communication more effective.
Internal comms people have sometimes seen themselves as the conscience of the organization. Do you think you've played that role on occasion?
I like to think of it as holding up a mirror sometimes. People still want to hide things. You know, they're nervous, they're worried about their personal, you know, the impersonal impact sometimes. And yet we know that if you can be really authentic and you can be open and honest with people at the right time, in the right way, that's a massively brave thing to do, but it also gives you, it really builds trust. But it's very, very uncomfortable, very uncomfortable. So I do think that sometimes those irritating internal comms people that we've been, and are, you know, asking those questions, it can cause problems. And you have to be pretty resilient. You also have to kind of understand when to give up and say, do you know what? We're not going to get past this. If we don't get past this, this is likely to be the outcome, but I've given you my best counsel.
Moving on from your kind of experiences and those early experiences in journalism, what are your memories of your first kind of quote-unquote corporate job?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, my first roles kind of after the sun were really in the wonderful world. And I still to this day was one of my favourite roles, and working, you know, with them and sort of setting up an agency and really creating an internal comms agency when really and truly there wasn't that sort of thing around. It was the 90s, it was London, it just wasn't that sort of thing. And I think that role for me, you know, it was mainly corporate writing and publications and things, terrifyingly pre-internet days, you know, pre-intranet. Or, I mean, any of that work that I did then, wonderful, because it was tapped into all my creativity, my love of editing, my love of storytelling, story sharing. I like to say story sharing, really, because to be honest, it shouldn't be about telling, it's sharing, isn't it? Like, we've always done that. I then went into, and this is where my internal comms really developed into more, I would guess, consultancy. It was when I left there and I moved to a number of agencies where I was giving consultancy in terms of crises. So I did work quite a while for an agency that placed me in, well, Railtrack as was, when they were having an absolutely terrible time. I don't know if you remember the nightmare that was Y2K, you know, where all the Millennium bug was going to eat our IT systems and prisoners were going to run amok on the street. Really and truly, the only people that benefited were all the IT consultants. Oh, so much money, but there you go. So I went into Railtrack as was to try and do Y2K. But while I was there, I ended up on the crisis for the Paddington rail disaster. So I suppose from a lot of quite joyous communication in the decade before, I then moved into some really gritty and challenging consulting on very difficult situations of death and disaster. And yeah, that was a really, I mean, it was incredibly emotional for everybody involved, completely the victims and their families, but also the shining the spotlight on what happens to employees being hounded by people and the press wanting their stories and just the difficult day-to-day of that, and then trying to sort out the rail industry in the wake of that. Well, how can we stop these things happening again? And that, I think, again, for me, from moving from storytelling, writing, sharing, really trying to connect people to making things better and having a better outcome, saving people's lives, very powerful. And I just found the whole thing incredibly rich in terms of experience and something that I felt I could actually build on and add to my skill set. It was a really good opportunity to move into something that I didn't really know I was going to like or do, but to find my feet and move my career into a different direction.
And I wanted to ask you, because you've been reflecting over sort of several years of experience there. I mean, how has internal comms and the entire communications landscape changed over the years you've sort of worked in the profession? I mean, I get asked about the blurring between internal and external comms a lot, just due to sort of recent experiences I've had. But how do you see just the change in the communications landscape? I mean, you touched on it a bit there, but what are your thoughts on that?
Well, I think that, you know, if I just look at the discipline of internal comms, I think some of the interesting additions to it, the expansion of it as a profession, are around behavioural change, about the role of leaders in connecting people with the purpose of an organisation. A lot more on the sort of employee value proposition, if you like. So, you know, what connects us to the world of work. So all of these extra things, I know there's a lot of talk about employee engagement and all of the different things that came after that. But, you know, why people are connected, what connects them? Is it purpose? I started to eat up much more things, you know, much more around some of the work related psychology, pieces from Harvard Business Review, things from Forbes, things in the HR arena, so the CIPD, genuinely been very lucky to work with people on various jobs. So, for example, lovely Hilary Scarlett, who I worked with, I had a great privilege of working with at Her Majesty's Revenue and Customs, who is all about neuroscience, and I've worked with her a few times in organisations. I brought her into organisations to talk with our leaders about, you know, change and why you feel the way you do and things like this. So I think, you know, I'm genuinely, again, it's the nosy Parker in me. I'm genuinely interested in what makes people tick. And so as new things have come in, I kind of like to explore them for myself. And I think we're so lucky that so many generous people are happy to share what they know. But on your comments about internal, external comms, I've always worked as closely, because I've been a journalist, I've always worked as closely as I can. And back in the day, I guess the external comms team were always a little bit suspicious why you as internal comms wanted anything to do with them. And sometimes, you know, you reported to HR or you reported to someone completely different. And so I'd always try and say, you know, we must try and work together. I think you and I, Sam, when we worked at the Cabinet Office, we were trying to join up and make sure that everyone worked in a integrative fashion. And I've certainly done that myself. I am very blessed in that I work in a completely integrated role now. I still think it's important that there's some important disciplines in internal comms, because, you know, employees are often, you know, your they're members of the public working with you, but they do have a more of a vested interest often in your organisation. So I do think it's important that you don't treat them as some homogenised mass. But I do think it's really valuable and powerful when you can bring together some disciplines around communication to run really effective campaigns. And so I often work with marketing, with public affairs, and it's been really, really valuable.
Now, you touched on somebody that you mentioned there, Hilary Scarlett, who you learned a lot from. I mean, have you had any favourite sort of bosses or line managers over the years, and why would you consider them such?
I have had many bosses. When you have a long career, you've had many, many bosses. And even though my first editor at the age of 18, when I was 18, was absolutely terrifying and insisted you call him Mr. and his surname, I won't say what it is, he taught me a hell of a lot. He actually, the National Council for the Training of Journalists, which is the industry body, they actually rated him. He was a local editor, but as one of the best local editors in the country in terms of his discipline for training journalists. And I worked on a local paper in Eastbourne, which was a simmering pot of intrigue and horror. When you actually, it's a bit like Twin Peaks, when you actually dig beneath the surface anywhere, you can find all sorts of stuff going on. But he was brilliant at educating us on the disciplines, the really good disciplines of journalism. And in those days, we had to get off our bottoms and go out and get those stories. It was a physical thing. And so I have to say that man, although he was terrifying, he was less terrifying as I worked with him. Taught me a hell of a lot about working to deadline, working, being resilient, and asking the right questions. So he's right up there. Then I've had a number through the years. I mean, I've mentioned the lovely Alan Heaford. Alan was just a joy to work with in the 90s in terms of his ambition for what we did as an agency and how we wanted to be really, really good at what we did. And we did some really creative things. And I think that creativity and that sort of schutzpah and that kind of energy that he had was with us at the time was brilliant. I mean, the guy had a fantastic sense of humour. I mean, he's hired me because I dropped something into my CV. This is after the Sun. I dropped something in my CV because I'd read somewhere when you do a CV, you should drop something in that's really going to catch their eye. And so because I'd obviously worked on the Sun and I was completely traumatised, really, thing I popped in was that in my spare time I loved mud wrestling. It wasn't the only thing I had in my CV, but it was one thing I had in my CV at the end where it says me hobbies. I thought, well, I like reading, I like going to the cinema, I love holidays, I want a bit of mud wrestling. And I just dropped it in a kind of exclamation mark, it's a bit of a laugh. Anyway, lovely Alan saw that and decided that anyone who put that into their CV was worth an interview. And I got the interview. But you know, he didn't have to harm me, but I can assure you I don't do my best things then or now. But we had a brilliant time together and I loved he was always a brilliant person for supporting his people. And I think for me that's a big trait of a really good leader. Not to the extent of kind of mollycoddling you or treating you in a way that, you know, is everything you do is golden. So totally being a leader who can say when you're not doing well but more of a coach, more of a kind of energizer. You felt anything was possible. I think I love a leader where you feel anything is possible and that they respect you for your talents. And I've been really lucky. I've had a number of those in my career. So for me, I think it's difficult to pick out too many people, but I mean, in Alan's case, I did a shrine to a pay rise as a bit of a joke in the agency office. Little shrine with little pictures of him and money from all over the world stuck all over it and some fairy lights. I did it as a bit of a joke and then horrifyingly brought a client round, but he didn't balk when the client came round. He said, oh yeah, man, that's just Sarah's shrine to a pay rise and she's not getting one.
The perfect retort, really.
But yeah, I think when a leader, when you've got a boss who can roll the sleeves up and get down and dirty with you as well, when the chips are down, I think for me that's instant respect. We all have different things that float our boat. For me, that kind of I'm not too high and mighty to not be able to roll my sleeves up and crack on when the chips are down. I think that's a really massive plus.
Join us in part two, where we talk about adapting to the future of internal communications, the period of COVID-19 that communicators lived through, and mentoring young people who are interested in a career in communications. Don't miss the next episode of Comms from the Shed.